Well, lest anyone should think Unitarians took the Bible seriously. If you're joining us for the first time today, you're catching us on a Sunday when we're taking up a thread that's been weaving through the course of this year in our worship, which is the exploration of Bible stories. And some UU congregations base their weekly worship and their sermons on passages from the Bible. But typically, today, in this tradition, the Bible is held equally alongside other scriptures and sacred texts and teachings from the world's traditions, and along with the great body of the world's wisdom literature. And so our desire is to find the universal themes of love and spiritual meaning and justice in the wisdom of the ages. And the Bible is understood in that context and visited periodically. So today we explore the story of Moses, the sixth story in our series, and incidentally and sadly, the last of these theatrical participatory renditions that Megan and I have so enjoyed putting together with you. Megan departs in a month, and I in 3 months, so if you've enjoyed these little extravaganzas, be sure to let her know, because she's certainly the creative drive behind them. Yes. And for some of us who came into a UU community in order to leave the Bible behind, perhaps the series has been an uncomfortable stretch at times, and this may be another example of that. Indeed, one might ask oneself, especially one might find oneself asking in the dark of Saturday night after having pasted a couple hundred felt leaves on a bunch of twigs, one might ask, how on earth do you interpret the character of Moses to a group of Unitarian Universalists? Making a bush burn with sacred fire is easy in comparison to presenting Moses in all his complexity. To explore the biblical character and story of Moses raises all the most difficult dilemmas of moral interpretation. The biography of this prophet contains difficult paradoxes and contradictions. It's the model of the very best and bravest, and then again, the worst and most inhumane. He's an exemplar of compassion and calling, of overcoming his fears in order to become a leader of selfless endurance and courage and ferocious advocacy. He not only faces and argues with Pharaoh on behalf of the Israelites, but once they're in the wilderness, with thousands of confused and griping freed slaves in tow, he must face and argue with God on behalf of the Israelites. Because Yahweh, I am, frequently loses patience with the wayward tribes and threatens to smite them before they ever reach the promised land. And so he has become the archetype of selfless leadership. And yet Moses also demonstrates the most brutal, and by that I mean the most violent, unwillingness to compromise when the people fail to recognize the supremacy of their God and to keep the covenantal practices. On a number of occasions, he orders the mass slaughter of pagans and idolaters, at one point essentially ordering the execution of 3,000 of his own people for this reason, and then sanctifying the Levite warriors who carried out his orders with the blessings of God. And so as to the question of how you interpret the character of Moses to a congregation of Unitarian Universalists, who are inevitably going to bring a hefty amount of skepticism, agnosticism, and contemporary moral bias to this listening, one sensible answer is, you don't try to interpret the character of Moses. At least not in terms that are spiritually and morally meaningful to religious liberals. The Judeo-Christian tradition claims Moses himself as the author of the 5 books of the Torah, including Exodus, the book that documents his entire life. And this, of course, is somewhat problematical because it also documents his death. But as liberals, we acknowledge that the scripture has had many authors who wrote from different historical contexts, with different audiences, with varying concerns. And so episodes that make up this character and narrative are, in a sense, a patchwork, and that is part of where his complexity comes from. And yet when you take it all together and you accept the extremes that are there, you have one of the most charismatic, powerful, fascinating, and dangerous, in a sense, archetypal figures portrayed in religious history, revered by Christians, Jews, Muslims. A mythic figure that lives eternally in our culture and art and legend. And when grappling with the biblical complexities, one has to bring an interpretive framework, a lens. A lens has the function of bringing certain things into focus and allowing other things, for the time being, to recede into the background. And so the lens that I want to peer through today, of the many, many that could be brought to this story, is the idea of human agency, human efficacy, as it interacts with the greater creative power, with providence, and some would say with the force of fate or history. So that quality of free will, the human power to change things. One of the themes that pervades Moses' story and the whole of Exodus is this idea of the guiding presence of the divine. So in the early story, it seems like this hand is guiding that little basket down the Nile toward his adoptive family. And in the midst of the wilderness, that guidance appears as a pillar of cloud by day and of fire by night, guiding Moses and the people through the wilderness and providing counsel to Moses atop the cloud-covered Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb. It's used, sometimes either one of those names is used for the holy mountain. So the divine is a very active guiding presence through the whole thing. And from this force comes not only guidance, but commandments, very different from the 10 suggestions that folks got a few weeks ago with Richard Trudeau when he was visiting our visiting speaker. These are not suggestions. These are commandments. And so it's easy to think of this as not only a guiding God, but a bullying God in a certain way. And yet there is hardly a book in the Bible that paints a clearer picture of human-divine partnership, almost inequality, really. That give and take, negotiation, mutual dependence. And in this sense, it's an interesting story. So Exodus makes it crystal clear that human will, human action and commitment, courage, speech, and force of presence are fundamentally necessary for the creation of justice and human fulfillment. Nothing, apparently, can be accomplished by God without it. And so from the perspective of this biblical story, we have a portrait of a full co-creative synergy. Human strength and ego forces on their own are not enough, according to this story. They flag, they weaken, they decay into mere self-interest. And yet neither are divine forces enough, as they cannot enter embodied into the human world where history is changed and created. As Rabbi David Cooper put it in the reading that we heard just a moment ago, clearly the word of God in Judaism has never been viewed as a final decree, but as an intention, a divine intention that can be debated and in some instances reversed. The linchpin of our relationship with the creative force is founded in the belief that human beings have the creative capability to intervene in the course of events. So every piece of the interconnected web is integral to the unfolding of creation, including us and all that we do or do not do. There's a great illustrative episode within Exodus that highlights this. The Israelites must do defensive battle against the Amalekites. And Moses bids the commander, Joshua, to lead the men in the fight. And then Moses climbs up to the top of the highest hill in the area, and he holds up his staff to the heavens, his shepherd's staff, the symbol of the true guide, the symbol of the focusing of power. So he holds it up to the sky like a lightning rod. And as long as he holds it up there, the Israelites prevail in the battle. And if he lowers the staff, it starts turning against them. So the hours go on, and he has to hold his staff up to the sky, but his strength starts to weaken and his arms grow weary, and it becomes more and more difficult for him to hold up his staff. And so then his brother Aaron and another elder, Hur, come and aid him. And they build a little stone bench underneath him to support him, because he's standing there on the mountain. They build a stone bench underneath him, and they hold up his arms. They're standing on either side of him, holding up his arms so that he can continue to point heavenward. And they remain like that for hours, Aaron and Hur helping Moses, Moses helping the warrior with his strength of presence, until the sun goes down and the Israelites successfully push back the Amalekites. There's nothing in this passage that says that the Israelite, that their God, intervened to assure their victory. It was a human accomplishment that required everybody's participation. But as I see it, it was Moses' insistence on orienting himself and the whole of the people correctly, pointing toward their spiritual truth, their covenant with God and with each other, that this was the decisive element. So pointing his staff heavenward was a ritual and symbolic gesture of leadership and clarity. It was about putting first things first, keeping things in the correct relation. And so Moses' life and leadership portrays a character who drew strength continually from his converse with the Holy One, and could not have been done, and he could not have done what he did. He could not have helped the people enter the Promised Land without that relationship. And yet he was also totally responsible. His own will, his strength, his intelligence, his reasoning was continually engaged and always culpable, along with everybody else's. And as I was contemplating this story, I found myself thinking about another Moses, a woman who earned that name because of her calling and her work as a fearless, unwavering, cunning liberator of her own enslaved people, Harriet Tubman. I don't know if you know that she was called the Moses of her people. So she herself, when she herself was still enslaved as a young woman, she received a devastating blow to her head from an enraged master. And as a result of this head injury, she experienced seizures for the rest of her life. And under these seizures, she would fall seemingly unconscious. And yet she said she not only was fully aware of what was happening around her, but she also experienced divine communications during these seizures. So these visions and her powerful dreams were a kind of parallel to Moses' conversations with the divine as they were in the wilderness in the book of Exodus. Indeed, Tubman knew and embraced the biblical story of Moses and the liberation of the Israelites, and this was her source of inspiration and her conviction. She felt her calling as if it came out of a sacred fire, like Moses' burning bush. So Tubman had a ferocious, unwavering faith in her intuitive inner guidance, and she saw it as fundamentally necessary to the accomplishment of her mission to lead as many people as possible out of slavery. Through the wilderness, through the safe houses of the Underground Railroad and up into Canada. It was a very difficult, very dangerous trek. She made it multiple times and never lost a single person on the way. And like Moses, Tubman was not afraid to use violence, not only to protect her flock, but to keep her people in line. She carried a pistol, and one story tells how when one member of the group that she was leading began to waver and doubt and whine and say he wanted to go back, she put the pistol unflinchingly to his head and told him he would either carry onward or die right there. So if you want to imagine what the prophet and leader Moses, what his intense gaze might have looked like, look into Harriet Tubman's eyes as she's been captured in photographs. I found a photograph of her when she's a very old woman. It's just a couple of years before she died, and the intensity of her face is so incredible. You can see that light coming out of it. One of the stories about Moses was that after so many conversations on the sacred mountain and, you know, in this converse with the holy power, his face became so luminous that people couldn't look at him anymore, and he had to cover it with a veil. So he spent the latter part of his life with a mask or a veil over his face, and you can see that kind of intensity come through the eyes of Harriet Tubman. There's no romance in that face. This is no sugar-sweet saint. Perhaps a saint, but wizened, hard as stone, dangerous as lightning, strong as an oak, and with that spirit of the creative power, that creative force of justice and compassion burning in her eyes and in her heart. Now, if we had not had the archetype of Moses, the biblical archetype of Moses, would we have had the Moses of her people, Harriet Tubman? Would she have found her way to be the leader that she was? I think she would have become the archetype, that somehow this needs to be embodied in the world, that the sacred power has to be impersonated in a ferocious personality that will do whatever it takes to lead people to the right path. And so we can use these stories for what inspiration they give us about what it means to rise above our limitations, to become who we're capable of being when we feel truly called to something.